University of Georgia Griffin campus invites you to join us for news and information about the many and varied programs and activities at the UGA Griffin campus. Information about gardening, the agriculture programs, and your UGA degree at the University of Georgia Griffin campus. Your UGA degree is closer than you think. This program is made possible by Frank and Carolyn Harris of Round Oak Resources Tree Farm and Murray & Company Realtors. Listen each Thursday at 9 o'clock a.m. for the UGA Griffin Campus News. This program is produced by WKEU AM 1450 and 102.3 FM and The Rock 88.9 FM and streamed live on our website, WKEUradio.com. Join us now with our guests from the UGA Griffin Campus.
And a pleasant good morning and welcome into a little bit of a late start here on the University of Georgia Griffin Campus News. And that's a shame because we've got two excellent guests today and we're actually going to do call-ins today. If you have any turf grass questions for Dr. Clint Waltz, who is the professor and turf grass extension specialist on the UGA Griffin Campus, or for Dr. David Bunton, I don't know that he actually wants to field questions, but we've got it out there anyway. He is the interim assistant provost and campus director at University of Georgia Griffin. They're both with us in studio. The number to call with your call-in questions is 770-227-5507. We'll put you immediately on the air and let you talk to Dr. Waltz directly. Dr. Waltz, welcome back to the program. It's been a pretty good while since we've had you on. There have been two masters since we last spoke.
There have, and thank you for having me back.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, just to remind the listeners who might not be as familiar with you as we are, just a little bit about yourself, your educational background, and your family life.
Sure. Been here in Griffin since 2001. Moved here, started as assistant professor, turf grass specialist, and prior to that, was at Clemson for master's and PhD. Before that was about 2.5 years at Augusta, working at Augusta National on the crew there. And then before that did my bachelor's at Clemson as well. So I'm a three-time offender of Clemson. And folks asked me, said, how did it go whenever I moved from South Carolina to here? I said, intelligence level on both sides of the river increased. been here, Griffin campus, turf program here at the University of Georgia is fantastic. Great group of folks to work with, and county agent statewide, turf industry statewide. Really enjoy my job and the folks I work for.
Now, how much travel is involved for you? I mean, there are 159 extension agencies in Georgia, so I mean, right. I would imagine your time is in quite a demand.
It is. I can stay on the road. Since the pandemic started, that has dramatically dropped off. And there's been some pluses and minuses to that. I've been able to kind of reevaluate some things and the way I do my job a little bit differently, and I think maybe even more efficiently going forward. So my guess is I'm going to burn a little bit less gas in the next 10 to 15 years of my career than I did in the first 20. But a lot of it is with county agents and county offices and doing county programs, but a lot of it and majority of my job is working with the turf industry statewide. So actually working with the industries, and that's I've got statewide responsibilities in all areas of turf. So that's golf courses, that's commercial lawn care, that's sports fields, that is sod production. And seem like I'm missing something right off the top of my head, but you know, that's a large part of it right there is working with the industry statewide. It's a huge industry and a major economic driver in this state.
Is there a dollar amount or an estimate of what the turf grass industry means to the economy of the state of Georgia?
Yeah, a couple of recent surveys have been out there. And you know, if you look at just the acreage alone in the state of Georgia, we're somewhere about 1.8, 1.9 million acres, which makes us, and that's home lawns, that's golf courses, that's sports fields. But that makes us really one of the largest ag commodities in the state, if you just look at it from that standpoint. But the green industry, as far as it was a regional benefit, you know, you start getting outside the state of Georgia, and our state certainly has an impact Alabama, South Carolina, Tennessee, North Florida, and further, almost a $10 billion a year regional impact from the state of Georgia in the green industry. And if you boil it down even more so, the impact of just the golf industry in this state is almost a $5 billion a year industry just out of golf on it. So it's a major economic driver in this state, just from that standpoint.
Has it been impacted? I see more people on the golf course here in the last couple of months than obviously were playing during the height of the pandemic. But has there been a negative impact, and is that starting to rebound, or was it pretty consistent all along?
Actually, it kind of took off a little bit.
And people had more time?
Had more time. Golf was outside, so it was one of the things, and the governor said early on that it was one of the critical industries, same thing with the green industry. So our commercial lawn care folks were continuing to operate. The golf courses were continuing to operate, and because people were, I don't want to say had more free time, because I want to assume everybody was doing their job from their home office, but we did see an increase in golf play statewide as well as nationally on it. So the golf industry has done exceptionally well the last 12, 14 months. Likewise, sod sales. So as people have been sitting inside and looking at the outside of that home office, they've done more work on and around the house. And you see that from various industries. But going back historically, whenever economics turn down and folks don't have expendable income to spend on vacations and that kind of thing, they put that money back into their home. So last spring of 2020, sod sales went up. We're seeing continuation of that this year as well. Sod sales are up, which means inventory's down, which means sod prices are going up. But the turf industry and the green industry has actually fared reasonably well through the pandemic.
I have a theory as to that. I think because people were working from home, they could do their work at 4 o'clock in the morning if they wanted to. They could do it at 8 o'clock in the evening and decided to spend their daytime hours out the door.
I agree with you. I think that does happen a good bit and has happened. And wouldn't surprise me at all if that gets to be a little bit more of a new trend going forward as well. The term a new normal is grossly overused, but I think there's a lot of truth to that that's going to happen going forward.
Now, Dr. Bunton, what is the impact from your end, from the campus director side? What does the turf grass program there at UGA mean to the school as a whole?
Yeah, good morning, Tony. Before I answer that question, I just want to mention I'm glad to see Dr. Waltz is not wearing a Clemson orange shirt today. as he normally does on campus. The turf program at the Griffin campus is one of our largest thrust areas, and the new building that was funded by the legislature and has really provided us the resources we need to do an excellent job with that, and we've been able to bring together all the faculty from different disciplines into one place in this new excellent building to focus on turf. And that's really created a lot of nice synergies going forward. And I'm sure I'll have to let Dr. Waltz talk about specifics, but we're really proud of that, and that's really turned out to be a great addition to the campus.
Do you have to kind of keep a little bit of a finger on the goings-on when new research projects or existing ones are being continued? Do you kind of have to be in the know, or is this something that you can turn over to the experts in the turf grass department?
Well, the main, like Dr. Waltz is in the Department of Crop and Soil Sciences, which is a huge department in our college. But we have people in entomology and in plant pathology.
Yourself are an entomologist?
Yeah, well, I'm not in turf. If you ever go to my house, you know why. But normally it's hands off. I don't have to really be directly involved. They have a what would you call it, an organizing guiding group, Dr. Raymer and Dr. Waltz, and a sort of direct the operations. The only time I get called in is when something breaks and they need some money to fix something. That seems to be my job.
Well, Dr. Waltz, you talked about how your job has been impacted and to a certain extent by the COVID pandemic, and you were able to stay in a little bit more than customarily you had become used to. Are there some changes that are going to be for the better that you've talked about going forward that will stick around, that will be beneficial not only to you but to people who need extension service help across the state? I mean, the virtual programming and things like that, is that going to be beneficial, or is this something that is better learned face-to-face?
I think it depends, Tony. I think we all very much are starting to crave a little bit more of that face-to-face interaction a little bit. So it wouldn't surprise me to see the pendulum swing back a little bit. But at the same time, I think we've got a number of specialists as well as agents and others that have gotten very versed at doing the virtual and seeing the benefits of doing virtual. Well, so I think you're going to see a little bit of a hybrid and a blend going forward. But I do think that there's still tremendous value of being in the classroom, whether it's doing continuing ed or professional education or in a classroom with students. So I think you're going to see a little bit more of that kind of, well, I know you're going to see that work back in to what level it's going to be and how it's going to be blended. I'm not quite sure yet. And I do think that's going to be a positive, but we're going to see some blend things and money's going to be a little bit more efficiently used in that respect.
Well, and one of your fields of expertise is sports fields, and so I always have to bring this up. I'm always fascinated by the amount of world-class events mm-hmm. that you have had a hand in. I mean, you've had a hand in Super Bowls, the Masters, the World Cup. Just tell the listeners a little bit about the sports side of things and some of the sure. turf that you've helped develop.
Well, our grass has been involved in some of those. I haven't been involved in actual all of those events. I still would like to.
Certainly, there is a sense of pride in watching and saying that's my grass.
Absolutely, and we got Super Bowl this past year, and word got out pretty quick that University of Georgia grass was being used at Super Bowl. So, I think I had three or four phone interviews and that kind of thing with reporters from all around the country as to about the grass at University of Georgia. So, I'm answering questions there. The NFL didn't have me down helping with anything, but maybe one day I'd very much enjoy doing something like that. But I have had assistance with some large sporting events. I've been a part of 26 Masters through the years events, and that's one that's always enjoyable to do. And I always bring back more than I think I contribute whenever I do that, because I'm around golf course superintendents and other turf professionals for a week, and you're just immersed in that for a week. So I'm always learning and picking up on it. We've been involved with me and my team have been involved with it's 13 or 14 now tour championships up in Atlanta. And again, industry support and helping this massive industry do the best it can, providing the best playing surfaces out there for golf. And then the same thing, we've been involved with the Atlanta Braves in the past, and as well as other projects like the Home Depot backyard and the Atlanta United and that type of thing too. So we have been involved in a number of things, me and my team, and we contribute where we can. And we're happy to do it. And then, like I said, there's a lot of times we're learning things such that the next one that comes along, we're able to be a little bit more impactful there.
Well, before we get to the meat and potatoes, let's go back to last November where the Masters had to be postponed because of COVID till November. To me, your team and whoever is responsible, the groundskeepers there at Augusta National,
absolutely.
Did a fabulous job. Watching from television, I really didn't notice much of a difference aside from a few azaleas.
Right.
How were you able to keep that course looking as green in the fall as it should look in the spring?
Well, you put the credit back really where it belongs, is that staff at Augusta National, the golf course superintendent and his staff at Augusta National, and the membership that has their faith and confidence in that group is where that belongs. When they bring us volunteers and tournament hires in to help out pull off that tournament, we're just the cavalry coming in. They're the ones getting it out done every day of the week. So as I tell people when it comes to that November 2020 Masters, I think I have a fairly decent vocabulary. So I can, I know a few words here and there, but the only word I have for that one is weird. I mean, it was just weird. There was no gallery. Players were out there. There were no ropes. Spouses kind of walked down fairways with some of the players. It was weird. And you're right. You kind of scratch your head sometimes after watching the Masters for so many years. Can we truly have a Masters without azaleas and pine pollen? Well, turns out you can, but it's different.
Yeah, I mean, it was a different experience, but I thought they pulled it off very nicely in the face of all the circumstances that
they did.
Caused that to happen. But now let's get into the meat and potatoes, the turf grass. I mean, you're always working on something.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the latest and cutting-edge research that's being done on the UGA Griffin campus and other University of Georgia campuses?
Well, between Griffin and University of Georgia is unique. There are a number of turf breeding programs around the country. Not every land-grant institution has a breeding program. But University of Georgia is unique in that we have two breeding programs. So there's one down in Tifton that's got a long history of turning out Bermuda grasses and centipede grasses and releasing those. And then we've got a breeding program right here in Griffin as well with our Seashore Paspalum and Tall Fescue program that Dr. Paul Raymer now has been running for, it's been 15 years or so now on it. So we've got other grasses that are coming out, and the fact that we've got two breeding programs that contribute back into not just Georgia, but throughout the world, really.
How difficult is it because, you know, the green industry, as you said, is coast to coast and it's even global. How difficult is it for you to develop grasses that may do well in other sections of the country, but you're having to do it in a Georgia climate?
You know, state of Georgia, we are diverse. You go from Tifton to Blairsville. So you've got a little bit of diversity statewide.
And a wide variety of different soils as well.
Absolutely. So, you know, we can't mimic everything, but we can do an awful lot. And we've got an excellent relationship with the turf industry. So being able to put our grasses in landscapes or on golf courses or sports fields to do testing, and that's one of the things we pride ourselves at the University of Georgia about our grasses, is we don't just see a new little thing and start chasing it. For a grass to go from beginning to the point where it's released and start to become economically commercially available to the end user, you're looking at somewhere 10, 12, 15 years between beginning to the point where somebody can buy it. So we know an awful lot about our grasses. I won't say we know everything about them by the time they get to the commercial side, but we know an awful lot about them, which is a little different than many other releases. So,
well, that's a big window. I mean, especially when you're talking 15 years, because you want to make sure everything is viable, diseases, and, you know, there's a wide variety.
That's right. The science is behind it whenever we release it. So you take something on one of our newest releases, and I say new, it's 5 years old or so now, is Tiff Tough Bermuda Grass. The real marketing thing behind it, or the real benefit to it, is its low water use. It uses about 35-40% less water than even a very efficient grass, which is Tiffway 419 Bermuda grass. So when we put these new grasses out, we're looking for new environmental benefits, we're looking for reduced inputs, we're looking for things that have a better pest profile, meaning they don't get them, diseases and insects or resistance to them, type of thing. So the science is behind these grasses whenever we release them, and we really try and put out a new product that is, you know, I call it sometimes the new and improved Tide. You know, we want to know what's in new and improved Tide when we release it.
Well, now, so we can engage, and remember, we do have a call-in feature added to the program today. If you have any questions about your own landscape, which we might have one right there with Dr. Clint Walls, let me snag this. Well, they are not there. So, the phone lines are open, 770-227-5507, without revealing trade secrets. You know, are there grasses that we may see in 5 to 10 years that will become widespread throughout Georgia and the rest of the nation?
Yeah, I think there's a couple that I'm aware of that may wind up making it onto the market in the next 2 to 3, and at least being introduced into the market in the next 2 to 3 years that are in the works.
And say a new grass is developed, as you talked about, how long does it take for it to gain commercial appeal? I mean, there are people who are going to jump on it right away and say, hey, this is the
right
next new thing. But then, you know, how long does it take for people to catch on that this will work in my yard?
Well, there's two parts to that. One is the production side. So even once we go into production with it, something other like a Bermuda grass or a Zoysia grass is going to take somewhere 14 to 24 months to get enough of it that you can actually sell. So there's a lot on the production side of getting to the point where we have enough grass or inventory to sell. And then we really don't do a lot of the marketing. We sell and license our grass to producers, and it's up to them to then do the marketing. So how aggressive they may be on the marketing side of that is up to them. So once we release a grass and it goes out into production, before it really accepts or hits widespread acceptance, I would say somewhere around 3 to 5 year period.
Okay. Now, well, you mentioned earlier that a lot of people decided in the COVID layoff to, well, we're going to resod our yard. For the people who did it at this time last year or around this time, what should they be seeing now?
Well, you've gone through one growing season last summer, and it was really a pretty good growing season. We got a lot of timely rains through that one. We didn't hit a lot of these. I refer to them as periodic droughts, but I'm hearing the other term now as flash droughts. So apparently I got to figure out what some of my terminology is there on difference between periodic drought and flash drought.
But flash drought will be the new normal.
I guess so on that one. But, you know, nonetheless, I've got to stay up on my terminology on some of these things. But we really didn't have a lot of that from a turf perspective last year, where we went more than, say, 10 or 12, 14 days without rainfall somewhere in the state on it. So last year was a good growing season for most of our grasses. So if it was laid last year and new sod went in last April, May, should have wound up growing in pretty well. This year, green up is always the first green up out of the year would be the touchy point. Again, we haven't had a particularly bad spring. Was it 3 weekends ago where we had a pretty good hard frost? That kind of that put the air brakes on some things a little bit and slowed them up for about 10 to 14 days. And I suspect this morning is going to be one that's going to put another 7 to 10 days a slowdown period on it. From what I'm seeing, upper 70s, low 80s next week. So that should help bring things back up a little bit. But I could see our Bermuda grasses, our Zoysia grasses, our centipede grasses taking a little bit of a slow up the next 5 to 7 days. We need the rain that we're getting or supposed to be getting this weekend. We are kind of starting to move into that periodic or flash drought period. We've had very little in April so far. And
We're well below normal for this time of year, especially when you compare it to last year.
And soil temperatures, and that's one of the bigger things with most of our warm season grasses is that 4-inch soil temperature. And soil temperature just now starting to get to about 65 degrees, and that's when we see significant root growth. And it's root growth that begins to take up water and nutrients, and that's when you follow the growth and that type of thing then follows behind it. So we just are getting to the climatic conditions where our warm season grasses will do more than just green up and be green. They'll actually start growing.
Now, if you want an insight onto the soil temperatures, you can use a wonderful tool that is put out by the University of Georgia. It's weather.uga.edu. You go to their calculator, which is towards the middle of the top of the page. The first selection is soil temperature. They will give you the 2-inch, 4-inch, and 8-inch depths. Yep. It's a wonderful tool. And 65 is generally the preferred soil temperature if you're going to lay new sod.
Absolutely. And quickly to be able to remember that website a little bit, it's just georgiaweather.net. GeorgiaWeather.net will take you.
I have it saved in our favorites, and it's what it reads in
yeah.
the middle.
But GeorgiaWeather.net will take you to our environmental monitoring network.
And they have it for all sections of the state.
They do, and here in Spalding County, we've got a couple of several, and one right there on the Griffin campus. So find the one closest to you, and then absolutely you can monitor your own our weather or environmental conditions, and we do have probes at 2, 4, and 6 inches, I believe is what that is on those. And for our warm season grasses, so those of you that have Bermuda grass, centipede grass, St. Augustine grass, Zoysia grass, those 4-inch soil temperatures, 65 degrees is when we start talking about putting down new grasses or fertilizer. That's when we want to make our first spring nitrogen fertilizer applications, when those soil temperatures are consistently 65 degrees. There's no sense in putting fertilizer out if the root activity isn't there to take it up. So now's the time to put out that, despite what's being said either through commercials or what's on the bags at the big box retails, the grass is going to react to environmental conditions. So we just are getting to a point now where roots will uptake that nitrogen or phosphorus or potassium that you're putting out in that fertilizer.
So if you were to say that you wanted to lay new sod this year, mm-hmm. April, May is the ideal time, so in theory.
Well, we can kind of lay grass up to and through August, but the sooner it goes down, the more roots you develop, and that certainly will help you move forward on things. So let's use the entire growing season. So absolutely, May, June is a great time to put down Bermuda grass, again, centipede, St. Augustine, or zoysia grass.
Do you recommend having your soil tested
Absolutely.
So you can find out what might work best for your particular property?
That's one of our first things that we recommend doing is doing a soil test, getting that to your local county extension office, and then sending that through the Ag Environmental Services Lab in Athens. They'll actually do the work. Our county offices just act as a conduit for that, and then you get some local interpretations too. So your county agent here can help with interpretation back from that lab, and that way as you're preparing, getting ready to put that new grass down, if there's any nutrients or pH change, soil chemistry change that needs to happen prior to that grass being down, we try to get that set such that it's most conducive for that grass whenever it's finally laid.
Well, you know, when you're dealing with people and dealing with their own landscapes, you run into two schools of thought: people who love being outdoors working in the yard, and then people who just despise it. Mm-hmm. And I will admit, I fall in that latter group. I hire mine out. I hate it so much. But so there are going to be people who really want to baby their grass and want their yards to look spectacular, and there are people like me, as long as it doesn't look horrible, we're okay. What kinds of grasses suit each type of person? For people who are willing to put the time in, what are some of the more efficient and nice looking grasses for our area that they might wish to plant?
It's an all personal preference, Tony.
Is it?
It is. That's a hard thing. And the other is trying to match the grass species to the proper environment. I often say if there's two things that you can do on the front end to solve 70-80% of your turf problems, not only now but 10 years from now, the two things you can do is put the right plant in the right place. So species selection, get the right plant and select the right species. Don't put Bermuda grass in a shady environment. Bermuda grass doesn't like shade. So whether you like grass or whether you don't like grass or whether you like being outside or don't be outside, put the right plant in the right place, and that's going to be a large part. And then the second part is site preparation. And that's where I see most people fail is grass just is sodded down. There's very little site prep done. Green side up gets to be the mentality on things, goes on hard ground. And you wonder why we don't have a whole lot of root structures because the site preparation wasn't done. So if we can pick the right grass to begin with and do a good job on site prep, and we develop a good strong root system from the very beginning, that's going to solve about 70-80% of your turf problems within the first 10 years that you own your house.
Well, now everybody who has grass at some point or another has to battle, except maybe Dr. Clint Waltz and the people at the UGA Turf, has to battle weeds.
Well, we do that too.
Are you a post-emergent or a pre-emergent herbicidist?
Answer to that one is, you know, is both.
Okay.
Pre-emergence herbicides are the backbone to our weed control in turf. So if you go back 30 years ago when we really didn't have a lot of really good pre-emergence, or the pre-emergence herbicides were just coming out, and post-emergence were really the way of weed control, that's the way we managed them, was let the weeds come up and we'd take care of them as they come up or shortly after. But the pre-emergence now really have reduced over the last 30 to 40 years the amount of post-emergence. But there's some things that are going to escape. Our pre-emergence don't always control all weed species. So you've got to have a blend of both, but you want to start off with a strong backbone, and your pre-emergence is part of it. So as we sit here, April 22nd, I think, so back half of April, or back third of April, the first pre-emergence herbicide application should have gone out prior to March 15th. Many times we talk about doing split application, so it's time for that split application to be, or that second application to be made. So if that first one went out somewhere March 1st, March 15th, typically we say come back in 30 to 45 days afterwards with the second for season-long weed control. And we've got a lot of those winter annual weeds that escape, so now's the time to maybe think about putting a little post-emergence out for some broadleaf, winter annual broadleaf weed control.
Now, for people who might have had fertilizer left over from the previous year, is there a shelf life on this? Is there a point where you would recommend maybe not use this anymore and go with something new? Or, you know, is it a matter of keeping it dry, keeping it moist, keeping it warm, cold? I mean, it's
all those are great questions. And the answer to that is not moist.
Okay, you want
most
dry.
Of our fertilizers are salts, so if you keep them in a moist spot, they're gonna kind of start to melt a little bit, and they'll get hardened up, and distribution on those is difficult.
Will they break down in the bag? Or
not really? No, you can have a little degradation. You're not going to lose the nutrient per se, but as far as it goes with the quality of the fertilizer itself, that can happen with time. But over a course of a year, that's generally not the case. If you got something that maybe 5-10 years old, that may be very much the case. It's more powdered, and as a result, it's not going to distribute as well. And fertilizer, just like pesticides, the key to that is even distribution. So if you've got something left over from last year, it's been kept in a cool, dry place in the garage, and it still runs through your fingers easy enough, then, yeah, go ahead and use it. That'll be fine. And many of our, like I said, most of our fertilizers are salts. So if they're hard as a brick and you can't break them up with a rubber mallet or something like that, then I really don't want to see those go into a landfill or anything along those lines, because there we run into some environmental hazards. But do your best to kind of break those up and get them distributed into some place where they would appropriately be used.
When you drive around just the Griffin area, Spalding County, I'm sure that to your trained eye, you can see things that we as just regular homeowners, landscapers miss right away. Are there any telltale signs to let us know that weeds are going to be particularly problematic in a given year? Are there little things that maybe people could look out for that can help them head off a problem before it gets out of hand?
I guess you got me stumped there a little bit. Every situation's a little different. If anything, it's more often landscapes with large trees and large trees and shade. Trying to grow grass under dense shade just isn't going to work. And folks trying to put a grass in an environmental condition where it's not. So I see more often than not where folks are trying to grow grass.
It's the placement thing you mentioned.
The placement thing. They're trying to grow grass in an environment that it's just not going to. And the thing that you also see, especially as we see in some new development going in, and I'm going to go ahead and forecast here in about 10 years, I'm going to get an awful lot of, it used to be the prettiest yard in the neighborhood. Landscapes mature with time, just like all of us. And so as those landscapes mature, the plant species within that landscape are going to change as well. And I see that very frequently. I'll be told, this was the prettiest centipede grass lawn 15 years ago. Yeah, that's when that maple tree was about 10 foot tall, not 15 or 20 foot tall on it.
W-K-U.
So, Clint, I've always heard that if you see broom sedge in the fall, you know, in your yard, that indicates you have a pH problem. Is that correct?
It can be. Yeah. Generally a low pH on that one. Not that broom sedge can't be a weed problem in lawns, but it tends not to like the low mowing heights that we put on it. So if you're keeping your lawn mowed inch and a half where it needs to be, you may not see that broom sedge, but if you got it all around some of the perimeters of your area and that kind of thing, then absolutely I'd have a soil check on that. Many of your older county agents or seasoned county agents will tell you, if you've got broom sedge in your pasture, lime it. So instead of trying to put out a herbicide for broom sedge, as you start changing the soil pH, and in that case, that weed will wind up disappear. So I would encourage a soil sample if you've got broom sedge around you.
So when you sod a yard, you really need some irrigation, right? How long do you really have to keep it, you know, wet to make sure that it is going to survive?
Right. Well, some of that's seasonal. Yeah. So if we're moving into this time of year, once that grass hits the ground, it has no root system. So, you know, I see people go out and want to soak their ever-living stew out of it. And you got to remember, there's no root system. So all you need to keep is the upper inch or so of soil below that sod moist. Mm-hmm. You don't need to keep it saturated. So you need to irrigate 1-3 times a day, and not an awful lot, just enough such as moving through that sod and keeping the upper inch or so of that soil moist. And this time of year, as our soil temperatures start to increase, those roots should go on out in the first 5 to 7 days, and then we'll back off of it and increase the amount of water. So then we want to start to irrigate, say, 2 inches down into the soil or 3 inches down into the soil. The 2010 Water Stewardship Act allows new establishments to be irrigated as need be, essentially, for the first 30 days. You know, at that point, then, if there are any water restrictions, that kind of thing, you've got to fall back to those. Unfortunately, I'm not aware of anything at this point that we have in Spalding County on a water restrictions. But for the first 2 weeks, you want to keep it good and moist, not saturated, where you're leaving footprints on it as you walk across it or anything along those lines.
Yeah, I think the long-range forecast for the summer is warm and dry this year.
Yeah.
So we may get into a situation where we need to look at the watering.
And, you know, that's where some of our newer grasses that are coming out of UGA, do benefit is that when you've got something like TIF TUF, it's a lower water using plant that still maintains commercial acceptability. So there's new lawns going in. There's a real advantage to we get into those flash droughts or periodic droughts or whatever we're going to call them. Being able to maintain color and density with less water is a real driving point to that grass.
All right, I'm going to ask you a silly question. I have dogs. Is there a turf that's better than another type of turf when you have dogs that do their thing in the yard?
So when you say doing their thing, we're not talking about making dog runs
I'm talking about business.
Yep, they're doing the business. What we see on that one many times, and there's actually there was a new research report, and I can't remember, there's a hormone that we typically see out of females that will actually cause a little bit more damage. Used to think it's a little bit more of a salt damage. And that female dogs were a little bit more destructive than male dogs because female dogs kind of do all their stuff in one spot, whereas boys like to kind of sprinkle it around a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's a concentration issue on it. But zoysia grasses tend to show that kind of damage more so than Bermuda grass or centipede grass on it. And I'll have folks ask me, say, what can I do to reduce it? And you don't want to say irrigate every day, but that's exactly what, because most of that is a hormone or a salt damage. So if we can dilute it, you know, the old solution to pollution is dilution adage. So that would be one thing, is irrigate or lightly water in after the end of the day or early in the morning, something along those lines to dilute some of that.
Well, thank you. That has just made my whole hour here worthwhile.
Yeah, well, I have the same issue. And if we have it, I'm sure we can't be the only ones listening to do. But, you know, you've got, as Dr. Bunton talked about, you've got this beautiful turf grass facility on there, and you've had it, what now, maybe 3-4 years? Has it been that long now since the turf grass facility has been on the Griffin campus?
It really came in the early mid 80s, yeah.
But I mean the new building.
Oh, the new building, yeah, that was, we started that in 2015,
it's been that long.
Yep.
How has that changed the landscape? I mean, do you see a correlation with the extra grants or more projects coming in?
Absolutely, and Dr. Raymer and I both have commented that what that building has done, bringing seven faculty members on campus under one roof, seven turf faculty member under one roof, the synergism that's happened there, the cross-pollination and then writing of grants and those type of things, we knew that would come along. We just didn't realize it would come along this quick. So the return on investment that the state put back into that building, and actually that was a statewide project back in 2014, it's turned around a whole lot faster than we anticipated. So the money that we've had coming in through federal grants, through industry grants and that type of thing has really surprised Paul or Dr. Raymer and I both as to how much that has happened. So, and it continues to. We're working on one now with some colleagues up at Rutgers, as a matter of fact. So that'd be another
UGA
federal grant.
And Rutgers do an awful lot of collaboration.
We do. They've got some good scientists, and we've got some good scientists, and, you know, you like to kind of get together. Not to mention one of those good scientists at Rutgers did her postdoc here in Griffin, 25 years ago. So she, Dr. Bingrui Wong, she's got a soft spot in her heart for Griffin and her faculty here, and she knows what she's working with. And likewise, we know what we're working with in Bingrui. So it's an excellent cross-collaboration there. But the building of taking and putting, like I said, seven faculty that were spread out, and Griffin campus isn't big. But when you're not under the same roof and you're seeing each other on a daily basis, just some of those discussions on things where projects could go and ideas and those kind of things just don't happen. Well, they have happened over the last 4 years in the new Turfgrass Research and Education Center. And as a result, our granting record, our publication record, has increased dramatically.
Now, how have the students benefited, of people who want to go into turfgrass for a career?
Mm-hmm.
How has the new facility changed their experience over what they might have experienced prior?
Well, in Griffin, we really don't have any turf students.
But they come in for research and things like
correct.
That.
Correct. And grad students. And when we designed the building, and that was another unique thing about the building, is typically buildings at the University of Georgia aren't built with faculty and, well, it's a bad way to say it, with faculty in mind, but
with
faculty
driven.
But with faculty input. Whereas the turf team here, we did have input, and one of the things we said we want to grow as we build this building is our graduate student education. So we actually put two rooms in there for with the intent of increasing graduate student numbers in Griffin. And we've done exactly that. They're overflowing. Year and a half ago this time, we were scratching our heads going, where are we going to put all of our graduate students? And then COVID hits, and you've got social distancing, and it's a matter of where we go put them now because we can't stick them in the room. They're too close to each other situation. But we certainly have increased our graduate student education in Griffin. The project or the state funding that came along for this, as I said, was a statewide initiative. So some money went to Athens for a teaching and research facility there with Dr. Gerald Henry. And that was directed towards undergraduate teaching and training that next group of golf course superintendents or sports field managers or commercial lawn care operators. We could use a few more folks that are interested in sod production because that's a hot area right now for farm managers and that type of thing. You could almost name your price if you knew how to grow grass and large acreage on it. But so some of that money did go to Athens and has benefited student program there in Athens.
So what was your route educationally? And then what would you recommend for students that want to get into turf grass or, as you say, sod production, since that seems to be where the money currently is?
Well, there's money all over it right now, but it's certainly a situation where I've had, over the last 12 months, I've had several sod producers in the state want to know if I have any students, know of any students, or know anybody that's looking that they could hire as a farm manager to grow grass. And you know, that's kind of a different bird out there, if you will. And there aren't many of those individuals that have that skill set.
But like when you started undergraduate at Clemson, you majored in?
Well, I'll start back further than that. How I got in the turf industry was I mowed yards. Went to high school in Gainesville, Florida. Mowed yards and made money mowing yards.
Well, you are an anathema to these University of Georgia people, aren't you?
And Dad was on faculty at UG or at UF, and on it, and enjoyed being outside. Enjoyed making money, and actually thought I wanted to be a landscape architect, and thought I could get into Clemson and landscape architect. But I learned my freshman year that I wasn't fit for that. That just didn't fit my mind frame. I had one horticulture plant class and essentially fell in love with plant sciences and the science aspect of it, not the creativity side of it on the landscape side. So from there, it really just became horticulture and plant science, and that's really what I enjoyed. Did a couple of summer internships at Augusta National. Enjoyed, again, being outside, working on a golf course, doing turf. At the end of my undergraduate, I was tired of being in school and wanted to get out and work for a while. But that was the best thing in the world because there I learned what I really wanted to do, which was be a resource to the turf industry. I met a lot of people in the industry. I met professors. Matter of fact, one of the most influential professors I met was Dr. Ed Brown at the University of Georgia, a former extension plant pathologist. He worked with Augusta National, and I was picking Ed's brain on this, that, and the other on things. And he very much encouraged me to go back to grad school. And I had an opportunity to go back to grad school and be a quasi-weed scientist at Clemson. And realized there that I enjoyed watching things die, which works well as a weed scientist because there you can spray things and watch weeds die. And they don't have six little legs and get up and crawl off or fly off like insects will. So weeds stay put, and you can kind of watch them die with time. And I enjoyed the weed science side of it and the plant side of it, and went from master's to a PhD to the University of Georgia. So some would say this is the, I guess, second real job I've ever had.
Well, you brought up something fascinating earlier when you talked about, you know, you're developing grasses that do not require as much as up to less 40% less water. You've got some that you're developing that may be a little more weed resistant, a little more insect resistant. How do those, especially those latter two things, the weed control and the insect control, how does that happen? I mean, what's the science behind that?
Well, the science behind that is paying attention to the grasses themselves, and it's much more complex than what I
mean. Everybody has bugs,
right? Every or diseases, but it's a matter of paying attention to them and making the right crosses with the parental lines and paying attention. And then you can get into the genetic side of it, of knowing where those particular genes are located and selecting towards those or programming towards some of those genes to be expressed that impart either disease resistance or insect resistance or what have you, or increased plant density. So we don't really control weeds as much as we increase plant density of our turf and make it more competitive. So it's more of an ecological fix, if you will. So the ecology of the turf outcompetes the ecology of the weed. As a former weed scientist used to say, and always liked his definition, is a weed is nothing more than an opportunistic plant. And Tim Murphy was very good about that. But, you know, weed is an opportunistic plant. So if we can reduce the opportunity for that weed to germinate and grow and actually have the grass there because it's a denser, more aggressive material, then we can reduce the weed species that we have in our lawns too.
Well, you've come a long way since being a landscaper. And we talked about some of the common mistakes that homeowners make in paring their landscape down. Are there common mistakes that landscapers make that maybe that they are unaware that they're making? I mean, some people cut it too high, some people cut it too low. Are there common mistakes that maybe that they didn't know they were making that they need to be up on?
Yeah, and it can be an sundry of things through the course of the year, more often than not, and I get it. I very much understand. It's a customer service type of thing. So when a customer says, I want my grass mowed a little higher, or I want it fertilized, many of our landscapers will capitulate and do exactly what the homeowner, because if they don't, the next guy down the street will.
Right.
The competition is there.
And there's a lot in Spalding County. I do know that.
And there are, and there are more coming in. But if we can get more of our landscapers to just stay with the agronomics of our grasses and try to stay true to the agronomics and be an advocate for the plant and not so much necessarily for – and this is Clint being idealistic for sure, but being an advocate for the plant and not for the commercial side and the money, we're going to have better lawns and that type of thing. So the landscaper probably knows, no, I need to be mowing that zoysia grass at an inch and a quarter, inch and a half. But when the homeowner says, I want it mowed up at 3 inches, again, they're going to mow it at 3 inches, because if they don't, there's somebody down the street that will for them on it. So just proper agronomics and trying to continue on professional education, because we do learn new things. And one of the things we do at the University of Georgia on the Griffin campus, every 2 years we do a research and education field day where we tracked in 800 to 1,000, or historically 800 to 1,000 attendees.
Have you ever walked through the parking lot on the days that you do those? Because they
I'm busy enough I don't get to, but yeah.
Those license plates are from everywhere.
They are. And that was another downside to COVID. 2020 was supposed to be our field day year, and just – to handle that size of group, logistics, we have to get started early on it. So we weren't able to do it last summer. Unclear directives or unknown directives as November, December of last year kind of really precluded us from 2021. So the plan right now is that we'll be back on schedule with our Turfgrass Research and Education Field Day in August of 2022. I haven't looked at the almanac yet, so I don't know exactly what will be the hottest day of 2022, but Turfgrass Research Field Day will be it, yes. So, absolutely.
Well, let me just real quickly, so Elizabeth Laney, Dr. Bunton's administrative assistant, doesn't skin me here. We do have a couple of announcements from the campus. A virtual information session on the Mary Frances Early College of Education Graduate School will be held May 3rd at 6 p.m. It'll give you the opportunity to learn about the kindergarten through 8th grade mathematics education degrees. Registration links can be found on the UGA Griffin website. That's an easy one, www.griffin.uga.edu. For information offered on the degrees, of any of the degrees offered on the UGA Griffin campus, can be found by visiting that website, or you can call Melissa Todd, 770-412-4400. And Continuing Ed is always offering meeting spaces for a wide variety of activities. Plus, they hold classes throughout the year once the pandemic kind of lessens up and allows us to get back into the swing of things. Again, give the campus a call at 770-412-4400. And if you're hungry, step out to the Dundee Cafe. Marcy Bradbury will be glad to see you, and take home one of her casseroles. And don't worry about cooking one night or two nights because these things are huge. They're outstanding. Just give them a call at the Dundee Cafe on the UGA Griffin campus. And she has a different menu every week, and they're all outstanding. We're in studio today with Dr. Clint Walsh, the professor and turfgrass extension specialist on the UGA Griffin campus and the assistant interim assistant provost. We just need to do away with the interim.
Absolutely.
That's just my own thought. And in behind the scenes at UGA, I don't mean to embarrass you, Dr. Button, but talking to people on campus, almost everyone universally wants the interim removed, and they want you just to be the provost and campus
yes,
director.
Yes, we do.
Dr. David Button. Look, I have contacts out there. I talk to a lot of people, and they all are in universal agreement that they hope that you stick around.
Well, thank you. We'll see how that goes. I think hopefully there will be progress in that area here in the next few months.
Now, was it, I mean, you know, and it's through no fault of anyone, but your job, your position became available when you were named interim at the same time basically Tifton's became available. Has that kind of slowed the search simply because they have more to look at because they have so many positions to fill?
The one in Tifton had actually been open before the one here, and they had an interim. So they were moving forward with the filling that position, went through a full search. When I started as interim, of course, I hadn't planned on being interim for 18 months. I started my 18th month on April 1st. I don't know, there's some joke there, I think. But but with COVID, the plan was the position would have been filled last year at the time. But with COVID and everything that was going on, that's all been delayed.
Well, back in after the post-Civil War days, William Sherman was asked once about running for president. And he said, if elected, I won't serve. If appointed, I won't hold the position. We're going to ask the same question of you. If they offer you the job, would you be willing to stick around?
Yes.
Good. Good. All right. So now I'm not trying to put you on the spot, Dr. Button, but I know that every once in a while somebody in Athens tunes in, and I'm an outsider, but I support you, and everybody on the campus does. So that ought to be at least a recommendation and a quarter.
Well, thank you, Tony. The check's in the mail.
But Dr. Waltz, any final thoughts? We're about to have to wrap up this week's program. Are there any final thoughts, anything that landscapers should know or should be planning to do over the next little bit to get their lawns looking good for the summer?
Well, at this point, we should be mowing lawns. My recommendation on that is let's be mowing them at the same mowing height that we took them into dormancy right now before we start getting bringing anything down in height of cut. Soil temperatures just are coming into the point where nutrients are going to be taken up and used by the plant. So that first nitrogen application moving forward can really start. I had a thought last week, but after last night, hopefully going forward, we're moving into warm weather and shorts weather. I'm looking forward to that myself. Let's pay attention to some of those drought forecasts. I've been hearing the same thing that Dr. Bunton referred
to. Longer range, we're looking at a dry summer.
Right, and as a result on that, things we want to do is right now, while we do have an opportunity to grow roots, let's do as much as we can to grow roots. So proper fertility, bring our mowing heights up a little bit. There is a relationship between height of cut and depth of roots. So the deeper our roots are, the more soil volume we have to pull water and nutrients out of when we do get into stress periods. So let's try to grow roots right now while we've got good environmental conditions, because we get into July and August when the environmental conditions are hot and dry, we're going to wish we had them.
And let me tell you, folks, everything that Dr. Walsh just said is absolutely true. Not that I'm an authority to question it, but he just took an awful lot of science and put it down in terms that even I can understand. So we do appreciate you being here. And Dr. Button, it's always a pleasure to see you, and good luck going forward. And I know we're going to have summer campus, the summer semester starting here about for much longer, and spring semester is going as well as can be hoped.
Yes, I think the spring semester's gone well. We've got two more weeks and then finals. We're going to do our restricted in-person graduation ceremony that we always do for graduates if they wish to participate on May 13th at the campus. They also have the opportunity to walk up in Athens. Okay. Some of that's virtual, some of that is in person. It depends what the degrees are. Summer session, where we're looking forward to getting back to a more the new normal back in the fall, but we're still waiting for guidance from the university, from Athens, and really from
USG
on what the procedures will be for fall semester.
And is there any impact, and just real quick, and I don't mean to make us run over time, but is there any impact that USG has announced that there would be no fee increases for the 2021-22 school year? I mean, University of Georgia Griffin is highly affordable, but is that a benefit to students as a whole that there's not going to be a price increase or a mandatory fee increase this year?
Well, certainly. It's always good that prices stay the same and don't go up. Our budget is flat for the year, though. We're not having a cut, which is another cut, which is good, but budgets are tight, but we made it through this year, and we'll make it through next year. So,
well, that means that we'll make it through the next year, too. We want to thank Dr. Clint Waltz, a professor and turf grass extension specialist on the UGA Griffin campus, and Dr. David Bunton, the interim, we're going to strike that word eventually, assistant provost and campus director, as well as being a professor of entomology. We hope that you've enjoyed this week's University of Georgia Griffin campus news. We hope that you'll be with us 167 hours from now for our next installment right here on WKEU AM and FM.